Titled this tape number 5 in the series, Crossing the Waterfront, for reasons which have long already clear to you, should become so during the course of this tape. Early bound I was, departing via the International Airport of Manila in the early hours of Monday morning. It was fine and efficient event by most standards, with a minor proviso that the departure hall had all the trappings of chaos, unskillfully minimized because of the low volume of people at that hour. Simple things such as luggage security clearance and where to go were a potential minefield whose danger was only temporarily mitigated. The flight was quiet and asleep restful until our arrival at Jakarta. Through the airport and out in towards the city, it was a peculiar holiday atmosphere to the whole place. Monday does not make sense. Eventually, the signs gave it away. It was marking the end of Ramadan, the month of fast. Western calendars are pretty chaotic when it comes to recognizing Islamic feast days as festivals and such. Very vague, of course. Anyway, a fond return to the wonderful organized chaos of the bus stations of Indonesia in relation to the Philippines, they seem to have much more character. I think it is a combination of having all the operations together in one complex, coupled with a higher level of utilization in terms of people coming and going, a sign of a growing economy in comparison to my previous country. Having more money was definitely a factor. My arrival in the bus station was just in time for a 24-hour journey east to Denpasar, the capital of Bali. Better to head out fast and back slow, I said. Seeing that I am now recording this in Sulawesi, I seem to be heading back pretty fast. Don't remember, this is one sentence, it doesn't make any sense. The bus journey was long and very comfortable. Plenty of legroom, actually far more than adequate. Reclining seats par excellence. Despite it, sleep is frequent and short. Not really much to do as we pass through the countryside. Begins to take on a monotony in the day as it progresses and as the sun goes down. The ferry trip early morning to Bali was quick and short. And then a very different world. Now each country has its own unique challenges as such. Certainly Bali was no exception by far. The initial experience was one of visual consternation. Like it seemed comparable from the day of the trip, the place was and is overrun with shrines and temples. The rich, multivariate, luminous green foliage reflects a fourth-dimensional perspective beneath a dense canopy. Each house has a temple, each field a shrine, and each village at least three temples, with the least important, that being for the dead, being furthest away from the mountain and closest to the sea. Quite an easy feat in a mountainous country surrounded by sea. The nature and structure of the religion, a mixture of Hinduism and Balinese animism, both simple and complex in itself. It pervades all aspects of life, right through to the daily offerings of each household and business, to its various shrines around its property. Offerings of food and flowers, a beautiful small display of colouring. The attention to detail is really impressive. The previous day's offerings are then placed or thrown on the ground for the less favoured gods. The fresh stuff is kept for the important gods each day. Then Passau itself, the town, the capital of Rye, has never allowed for the widening of its streets, which play host to a near 20-hour daily Indy Grand Prix across the road, particularly after a month of right-hand driving in the Philippines, which way was which, and this with all its one-way streets. It's a noisy, busy city of a quarter of a million people. The center is surprisingly small, a transit town for many tourists, for a bit of last-minute shopping or whatever, or perhaps just escaping the tourist beaches of Kuta, Legian, or Senua to the south. There's all very little to keep you in this place. Culture bound to a Buddha was very quickly. The culture center of Bali set pleasantly amongst rolling hills, gently covered with rice fields, with scores of temples and tourists. Perhaps the temples are trying to outnumber the tourists in a furious silent battle. Accommodation and food and travel places abound in bounty in this little town, but aside from the gamelan practice, there is an air of tranquility to the setting. Gamelan practice can disturb even the dead. With the benefit of hindsight, a diarist's delight, I clearly failed to grasp the effervescence of Bali. It was probably lost and buried in the noise of Den Passau. The first Dutch ships to Bali lost half their crew to this paradise. The problem with paradises these days, is the joint joys and evils of communication systems. All is revealed so quickly, and against this foreign invader, this bell of paradise is suffering and bravely fighting. Tourism has done much to try and destroy the beautiful culture of this part of the world. It seems to have failed thanks to the resilience of the people themselves, who have fought hard to preserve their indigenous way of life. So this battle reflects the essence of the Buddha, as it represents vividly in its glory and all. That bold frontier zone between culture is built up over thousands of years and the decadence of modernization. What entitles a photographer to climb onto the stage during a dance performance to take a photograph or two of the orchestra, or the gamelan as they are known locally, is a camera and a passport to any sort of vulgarity. Imagine a funeral in Europe or anywhere. You pick the victim country. The mourners gather at the house of the deceased before proceeding to the service and the burial. In the meantime, the equivalent of 2 to 3 busloads of tourists arrive in order to photograph and record the ceremony for their own benefit. Imagine. Not all funerals are open. In fact, there was only one during the week which I was in the book. Clear evidence of this. Said not everybody has decided to open themselves or open arms to the tourist. And anyway, what of the funeral itself? Certainly, from a purely selfish point, it was extremely interesting to see the process. Outside the house were two large platforms, each of which capable of being carried by between 15 and 20 pallbearers. On one, the first in the procession, a large, full-sized effigy, in black, adorned with gold and various other trimmings. The second part carried a base and receptacle for the coffin, and was adorned by several pagoda-type structures, the height of which indicating the importance of the deceased. Body funerals are, for all intents and purposes, happy occasions. And it is that single aspect that perhaps allows the intrusion of us. The coffin is removed from the house and placed upon the second part. The pallbearer is raised to 2 other shoulders, and a slow walk begins. First the bull, then the coffin, then the family, then the gamelan orchestra, and then the tourists. Roughly in that order, because slowly the pace begins to quicken, and the cart carrying the coffin does a few 363 turns to confuse the spirit, lest it ever desires to return. The gamelan offers for a beauty, a lively tune. Not so much a lively tune, but a very noisy tune. Very soon we are doing a very fast walk, or to many people, a reasonable jog. This was in the midday heat. Many of the tourists were soon taking strain down valley to a riverbed and up the other side and across a rice field to the temple, all in all about 3 kilometers in distance. The coffin was then transferred to the inside of the bull effigy, and the cremation of the whole lot begins to take place. The deceased goes along with various garments and food which is needed for the afterlife and the final rattling of the bones brings a near end to this process. The tourists scatter back in the different directions, leaving the family and fellow mourners to a meal. The overriding impression of a good is one of being happy to witness these events. These attempts to preserve an indigenous culture, a difficult task when the demon of tourism puts on an alluring performance of material enticement. Before moving on, let's not forget two things that have also occurred during my short stay here. The traditional dinner held at the local homestead. The terminology homestay and Osman being interchangeable. Yes, a wide array of dishes were placed before us, with two meat dishes in the form of satay of duck, chicken, complemented superbly with a blend of spices. The other bearing red dishes, mainly vegetable compositions, each of which with strong, pleasantly good individuality. The whole lot together was absolutely great. The second point of note was a pleasant little pub called a Beggar's Bush, home to the Hash Harriers, the origin of which should be the subject of another tape, I'm sure, which joins the other few pubs, namely the Lock, Stock and Barn in Singapore, and the Slouch Hat of Manila, even what I consider superb pubs so far. 3 in 4 months is not too bad. The service is friendly, the atmosphere relaxed, and the company good. Easy to say, but difficult to find. A short bus trip during the day, where the clouds look down ominously upon the terrain which saw us climb gradually past a quickly dissipating range of craft shops. It's hard to imagine how you can have so many craft shops. Wonderful carving, wooden carvings, 15, 20 foot high, here for the special occasions. Anyway, we pass all these craft shops, nearly a national symbol in Bali. Through the falling mist, we were beginning to hit another rain wave. We reached the end of our ascent and were discharged on the narrow crater rim of Bulanbatur. Not too narrow indeed, but sufficiently wide for the growing number of restaurants which cater for the busy tourist trade, mainly June to September. The weather is always described as being very unusual for this time of the year. It was beginning to get to me. And for a week further was to battle this region of Bali and Lombok. Sought for help from other people. Everybody was trying to escape it and nobody was succeeding. Finding accommodation at the edge of the crater with view was at first variable and intermittent. Clear weather would reveal the ground falling away to the crater floor some 600 meters below. Crater floor, which then rises in the center to give another volcano, a volcano within a volcano. Upon or within the main crater lay a large lake. This place hosts a particularly resilient fish population, which provides a job opportunity for the resident human population, and an interesting delicacy to savour. The crater has, I reckon, a diameter of about 14 kilometres. Now it's quite big now. In the middle rises up Mount Batur, some 700 to 750 metres, to a height of 1750 meters above sea level. To the south of the crater rim rises up the Gung, the name of the mountain. A tall, imposing mountain which helps set the scene beautifully. But for the 3 hours until 5 o'clock or so that afternoon, I saw but a bit of each at any one time, as the mists danced, twirled, and swirled to a silent rhythm. Then, to the piper of sunset, all was clear in its beauty. It was inspiring enough for me to walk down the following morning along a road beside which now lay silent, dead lava streams, to reach the village of Turtur, which lies at the foot of Mount Fatur, between Mount Fatur and the lake, a beautiful setting rain of camps. Basically, you're just at the bottom of the volcano, the crater. Okay, by now it was raining heavy and steadily. The quality of the local fish made life a bit better, and this was a solitary comfort in this damp world. The rain abated about 4 a.m. the following morning to allow the climb to start, and we commenced at 4:30. Yeah, wasn't very good. We reached the top at about 5:30, a fairly short walk, for the start of some really heavy rain. Shelter in a little hut. Yeah, that's what it was. Or some hard-boiled eggs, toast and tea. Civilized, maybe, but the crater was a source of many unconventional noises. Pangs of hunger, no doubt. We descended shortly afterwards, soaked. I spent the rest of the day trying to dry out, and also trying to get over this place pretty quickly. The rain may have seemed to be lifting, but my departure was rapid towards the coast. Fortunately, because the rain wasn't lifting. And on to the little port of Padang Bay, a very quiet, pretty sort of village, where the accommodation stretches, straddles the crescent-shaped bay. The weather was slowly improving as the day progressed, and other travellers come to convey the same story, rain and valley, untypical, everywhere, escape. Yes, simple orders. Maybe Lombok would be better. The ferry trip was by an efficient-looking and efficient-in-reality operation. Pleasant crossing of some 3 hours on the top deck, cooled by a refreshing breeze, followed by a quick and speedy journey to the northwest of this island. Yes, Wallace is definitely right. But to get a whole line, the Wallace line named after you, for a bit of none too special observation skills is a bit much. You see, one is very lush, Lombok dry. Vegetation differs. Animal life differs. Monkeys and Bali, which also form part of the temple traditions, which you will not find in neighboring Lombok. Big differences in between the two, particularly for such a short distance. Anyway, that's what Wallace was. It's also the answer to your question in Trivial Pursuit. The journey to the northwest is through some luscious parts. This was the exception to the Wallace line theory. But the general impression is significantly less water and a more arid fauna and flora. Eventually, arriving at morning, Gili Islands, three islands, Giliere, Gili Mino, and Gili Trawangan. I stayed at Gili Trawangan. These are just three islands a bit too difficult to get to, thereby avoiding the density of tourist activities which accompany the nearby Bali resorts. The largest island, Gili Trawangan, is about 5 kilometres around and flat, except for a hill. Well, couldn't be for anything else but a hill, where the Japanese had a few guns during the course of the Second World War. Visiting the site, it seemed that some troops had it quite easy for the duration of the war, because the views across to Mount Rinjani on Lombok itself, or back to Mount Abang on Bali, are stunning. Particularly seeing the sun rises over the former and sets upon the latter, both imposing volcanoes. The people have decided to avoid large-scale development, and everybody appears involved in the provision of lodging houses, food, or other similar tourist services. There is little to do here except lie on the beach, snorkel, or fail miserably in trying to update this diary. You're still failing again. The food has been turned down, tuned down to meet the tourist need, a feature too common in too many tourist resorts, one which I think I'm probably repeating. The city of the Zions, the sunrises and sunsets, representing two of the three S's which dominate local activity. The third, you can guess, is sunburn. This is one of those nice places where days can easily become weeks. But Lydia's massage was the high point of my days there, an hour long, and the effect was great. I could feel the knots being undone, I think caused by sleeping in crazy places over the preceding months. The real pain was in getting the knots out. It was a difficult massage. It was certainly very different to spider massage in Angeles. The application of technique varied. I can still remember the feel of an oil as it burned into my body, as it penetrated slowly the fiery sensation. Yes, even with the fire, Lydia's was still quite a bit tamer than the spider massage. Anyway, not to rest too long, a few days here and we're off again in transit. Some 30 hours of variety was to lie ahead. A small boat back to the mainland with about 15 fellow travelers aboard for an hour or so, including a few minutes, could have been hours, when the engine gave out and we drifted in a fast current towards the open sea, giving rise to some more interesting possibilities for this trip to ultimate destinations. A few bus trips on the mainland and we're off in the eastward direction, as said eastward. The ferry to Sumbawa was less organized than the Bali to Lombok, but still efficiently run, very quickly. And as the sun set, we arrived. The terrain was decidedly rougher and more arid, despite the presence of some rice fields. The housing and villages were decidedly poor, being reflected in the general shabbiness of all. In fact, some 30 years prior to Krakatoa erupting, a major volcano erupted on this island, devastating, wiping out most of the population. It was in fact reckoned to be more significant than Krakatoa, and goes relatively unrecorded in history, because 30 years made a big advance in communications back then. Arriving in the capital town of Bima around 2 in the morning, I waited 2 to 3 hours before the process of passenger collecting began. This time more annoying because we spent over an hour at it, including one time when we drove out of the bus station without light at all before the sun had risen. We chased down the street by one passenger who feared that they would be left behind. Never the fear. Seems that even the locals get confused by this process of killing, driving around looking for passengers. Eventually, fully laden, the bone crusher was off towards the harbour of Sapi on the eastern coastline, a modern-looking complex by Sumbawa standards. The rest of the place is definitely very dilapidated. There is not much here to detain the tourist in an island, which is scenically pleasant, but not too exciting by the standards of its neighbours. My opinion, of course, was confirmed by many other fellow travellers, some of them even brave to stay there a few days. Now this ferry from Sapi was a rust boat by any comparison. It was smaller, but the passengers were left in a room of little fresh air for a trip of 5 hours. Spilt drinks, people sick, and this was a calm journey. It could be a hell of a trip. The scattering of other travellers, willing to engage readily in conversation in order to relieve the pervasive boredom. The heat of the day bore down on what was a sense of tedium of a lengthy voyage. Through very many islands of zero or little population, we wound away. At one stage, we maneuvered sharply and suddenly to avoid a large, very large log floating in the sea. Seems a natural hazard. Eventually, we came to a halt, dropping anchors. I think we dropped anchors, I don't think we really did. As a small boat pulled alongside us. Piracy? Not really. Our next transport. And some 15 or so people boarded us with their rucksacks. And I, along with about a similar number of 15, boarded this little boat. As the ferry pulled away into the east again, we had a feeling of being abandoned in this great sea of many islands. We chugged away slowly towards our eventual destination. About an hour away, the tempo of conversation grew more excited in a peculiar way. It was only in the 1950s that Attenborough came in here in a far more primitive consideration, and subsequently wrote a book titled The Zoo Quest for a Dragon. As we approached the beach, somebody said, "I suppose we'd see a made big dragon on this beach." Yes, no sooner were the words said than out of the bush came a big dragon, some 2 meters long. A slumbering giant, he made his appearance and his disappearance fairly quickly. Everything on this island is bigger, not only the dragons. It seems that the rats, none seen by myself, are said to be very large, good dog size. The geckos are 8 inches long without the tail. With tail, we can put them over a foot. Then there are very few mosquitoes or spiders to terrorize one during one's sleep at night. I threw my torch at this gecko, and that was the last I ever saw of it. And you think I joke? Last night, yes, I saw a large cricket and a gecko square up to each other. Eventually, the gecko backed down. Okay, it was a fairly small gecko, but this was a big cricket. Relatively early one morning, a group of about 20 of us headed off to where the group of dragons hang out, so to speak. Annoyingly, we made enough noise to scare the inmates of Jurassic Park alone, let alone a few auras, O-R-A-S-E-S, local dragons are. As we approached the clearing, a group of about 20 to 25 fully grown stars lumbered into action. Two particularly large ones, some 3 to 4 meters in length, came down the path towards us in our direction. We buried ourselves in the nearby bush. The guards kept them at bay with some sticks only some 4 feet long. It seems that they were easily deterred. The rest of them headed down into a riverine gorge, a dry one, to await, at least in their view, a potential feeding time. While the others approached us in a lazy, haphazard manner. Into a fenced enclosure we went, to escape their curiosity, and to take our photographs from safety. It seems that they are more curious about us than we about them. Later on that day, I headed up along the beach in the general direction of the local village. There were a few hundred people, about 70 fishing boats lazed loungingly in the open bay. Whilst the houses and stilts represented quite a wide variety of housing styles, construction techniques, and building materials. A few sported TV aerials, the TVs broadcasting loudly, and a large building contained, yes, even a satellite dish, price of progress. Through the village and up the other side comes a small hill, the sea quietly calm below. There was a range and number of other islands, green vegetation, few trees, and white sandy beaches. None of them too flat, all very hilly, all under a soft, warm sky, which completed the picture of peace. What was pleasantly surprising was the real absence of people other than in the village. And yes, the sight of one or two daily ferries, one going east to west and the other west to east, slowly stopping and discharging its quota of travellers and other goods, all vital ingredients to this part of the world. By the way, these dragons are nothing more than giant monitor lizards and have only been known occasionally to feed themselves on tourists. And that brings us to the end of side one. Well, more or less actually, seeing that the next day we're really heading off into a completely different country. So therefore we can't put anything more onto this side.